Today's Teisho will be on case 43 in the Book of Serenity. Case 43 is entitled Luoshans Arising and Vanishing. Introduction. One touch of the philosopher's stone turns iron into gold. One word of the ultimate principle transforms an ordinary man into a sage. If you know that gold and iron are not two, that ordinary and sage are fundamentally the same, then after all, you'll have no use for it. But tell me, what one touch is it? Luoshan asked Yanto, when arising and vanishing go on ceasingly, what then? Yanto shouted, and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? Verse, severing old entangled vines, opening up a fox's lair, a leopard covers itself with fog in order to change its spots, a dragon rides the thunder to change its bones, bah, arising and vanishing in profusion. What is it? Summer is really here. It's really quite beautiful. A few weeks ago, we had our sesshin, our May sesshin, and it was just the perfect weather, and all the birds were singing. It's really, really quite wonderful. For a long time, I didn't realize that you could attract hummingbirds here in New Jersey. You know, out west, there's quite a few different kinds of hummingbirds. In Albuquerque, where my wife is from, people hang feeders up for them. And they come in large numbers, and they fight it out over the sweet water, sugared water. And I never knew that there were hummingbirds here, but somebody told us that there were. And we put up a hummingbird feeder, which is basically an inverted test tube with a stopper and a little drip mechanism. And lo and behold, over the last couple of years, we've had hummingbirds. There's a ruby-throated hummingbird. It's an East Coast hummingbird. And about just before sesshin, I put out the feeder for the hummingbird, and you're supposed to make a formula of four parts water to one part sugar. So I made the formula, and I hung the feeder out and waited, and nothing happened. And then sesshin came, and I came back from sesshin, and believe it or not, I was actually thinking about this on the last day of sesshin. I was wondering if the hummingbirds were here yet. A few days ago, I was sitting in the backyard, and all of a sudden, a hummingbird came up. And then they're very, very small. I was reading online that a hummingbird is the weight of 2.5 paperclips. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? 2.5 paperclips. And these little birds come all the way up from Mexico. You know, they fly out of Mexico. They fly over the Gulf of Mexico, which is 600 miles. And they come all the way for some reason, they come up here to New Jersey. Maybe to get sugar, you know, sugared water. So anyway, they flew all that way, like from the Yucatan Peninsula across the Gulf of Mexico. And it says they store up energy to make the trip. It's like, but they weigh 2.5 paper clips, you know, how's that possible? But these little birds are just amazing, you know. And they arrive here in New Jersey around this time, And they're just little gems, and they come up, and they drink, and then they just zip right across the yard, and it's like in a flash, you know. And, I've seen pictures of their nests, and their nests are very tiny. You would never notice one of their nests, and they have tiny little eggs, you know. It's so wonderful to see the hummingbird come again this year. The hummingbirds come again this year. It's so, they're so beautiful and precious. And it's so remarkable that here they are again. You know, many years ago, I lived in Seattle. My wife and I lived in Seattle, and we lived on 9th Avenue next to the university. And we had a tiny little house. It was just a tiny, these were a little tiny houses built in the 1930s or the 1920s. And they were all in a row, and they were they were like a row, little row houses, and we had a tiny little strip of land between the sidewalk in front of our house and the road. And my wife, who is an incredible bird fancier, used to put out seed for the birds. And we had a pine tree also out in front of the place where we lived. And I would get up in the morning sometimes, and she would feed the birds. She'd throw food out for the birds, and there were so many birds in that tree, you could hardly concentrate. They were cackling and singing and chortling so loud. And then when you would throw seed out, you could actually hear them crunching the seeds, so there was like a crunching noise. Anyway, I don't know how it happened, but one day I watched my wife go out of our little house, and she threw some cracked corn down on that on the strip of grass between the sidewalk and the road. And I had never paid attention. I was busy with other things. But she walked outside one day. She threw some cracked corn down, and it was the most astonishing thing. I'm not telling you a story to make a point. This really happened. It was astonishing. A duck flew out of the sky and came down and ate the cracked corn. It must have been, I don't know, hundreds of feet up in the sky. And it and I said to Barbara, "That's amazing." You know, she said, "Oh, they come back every year." You know. So she had trained these ducks, don't ask me how or why, to come back to our little house in Seattle every year, and they would zero in and fly down and have some cracked corn. So, you know, these things, when these things happen, they're quite remarkable, you know. The hummingbirds every year come from Mexico, and they come up to New Jersey. And, you know, these birds have their seasonal migrations. And for years and years, my wife would buy cracked corn in the spring, put it in the most unlikely spot, and out of the sky would come ducks, maybe generations of ducks, who would remember to stop by our house for some cracked corn. And it was dependable, right? We count on these repetitious events. You know, we even take them for granted. You know, it's easy to forget that everything is very precious and very, very fragile and really temporary. You know, I'm hoping that the hummingbirds come next year and next year and the year after that and the year after that. They might not, you know. The spring might come and what do you know, no hummingbirds. These things happen all the time, you know. For years, where we lived, there used to be turkeys who would come by our house, usually in late winter. And there, as you know, New Jersey has quite a large turkey population. And pretty much we could almost count on it. It seemed like many winters in a row, in the late winter when turkeys were really getting hungry, they would come by our house. And sometimes they would sit on our cars. And turkeys are quite big birds, so usually there would be some snow on the ground, and I would see one morning I'd get up and there would be the turkeys in our yard or on our cars, and I would throw some food out for them, and they would eat the food. They're very careful around humans. They're not friendly. They're very shy. And for years and years they came, and then for some reason they've just stopped coming. And I have to tell you, I miss the turkeys, you know. I miss them not coming. I thought they would be there every year, but they weren't. You know, so we have this mind that basically looks for these patterns of repetition, and we count on them being there, right? I mean, this is just a fact, you know. And then, of course, one day something changes, you know. And that can be the occasion for a lot of distress. For years and years, you know, I used to call my mother on the phone. My mother retired in Southern Virginia, down near Williamsburg, if you know where Williamsburg is. And I used to call her just about once a week. And I would have some problem at work or some problem in my personal life. And I would call up my mother and I would just talk to my mom. We had a very good relationship. And it was like once a week, it's time to call my mother. I know people who really don't like to talk to their mothers, you know. They dread it and they feel it is this heavy obligation. But I would actually look forward to my, it was like a free therapy session with my mom, you know. So I could call my mother and tell her about my suffering, and she would tell me, "Don't worry, I'm sure you'll handle the problem. You know, you have inner resources. Just use your inner." "Oh, thanks, Mom. I feel so much better, you know." So it was great. I mean, my mother was a good person to talk to because she always bucked me up and encouraged me and told me what a good boy I was. So this went on for years and years, you know. And then one day my mother didn't call anymore because my mother isn't around anymore. So, you know, when these things happen, that's difficult to deal with, right? You know, we count on these repetitious events. And then, you know, we begin to notice that something is changing. And that can be very hard, those moments where the birds don't come back, the turkeys don't come back, or, you know, you pick up the phone and you realize there's nobody on the other end of the phone. That can be a difficult moment, you know, what now? In Buddhism, we're told that impermanence is quite important. The great Zen master Shunryu Suzuki was asked once, "What is the essence of Buddhism?" And he said, he could have said many things. They asked him, "What is the essence of Buddhism?" And he said, "Everything changes." And I think that's very, very deep. You know, very deep practice. You might not know the story about Shunryu Suzuki, but he was quite a respected Zen master in Japan, and he ran a temple in Japan. And at one point, at one point, a person came to his temple who was mentally ill, you know, like clearly quite mentally ill, in not a harmless way, in a way that made people nervous. And Shunryu Suzuki, quite correctly thought that Zen would help this person. And at some point, some of his advisors came to see him, some other people in the Sangha, and they said, "You know, you really need to get rid of him. He's dangerous." And Suzuki said, "I'm not going to ask him to leave because he's in great distress, and I think he could benefit from this practice, and that it's your practice to deal with this person, you know." And then this is this part where hang on to your cushions, but actually, he killed Shunryu Suzuki's daughter. I've always wondered how he dealt with that. You know, I mean, That's actually such a difficult event to talk about or even to think about that it's often not even mentioned in biographies of Suzuki. Basically, that's part of his history. You know, after that event, he came to the United States and he started the San Francisco Zen Center and was a brilliant teacher, you know, brilliant, brilliant teacher. And I often think about, when I think about him, I often think, how did he do that? You know, how did he do that? Because, you know, I think most people would probably find an event like that insurmountable, right? I mean, you can imagine how most people would, say, blame themselves, would be very guilty, would, you know, descend into all kinds of self-destructive thinking and so on. And for some amazing reason, you know, some amazing reason, Shunryu Suzuki didn't behave that way. You know, he went on with his life in this very, very creative way. And he created really what is probably the most successful Zen community in the United States. And people said he was really a deeply compassionate and very powerful person. He inspired lots of people to practice Zen quite seriously. If you've ever read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, if you haven't read it, I urge you to read it. It's not Rinzai Zen. It's not Koan Zen. It's really pure Soto, pure Zaotong Zen. And it's really quite a wonderful book. You know, a friend of mine, a Roshi friend of mine, told me that that book is the best-selling Zen book of all times. And that basically the press that that used to publish the book, Weatherhill Press, used to publish quite a few books on Buddhism, but that book sold so well that it kept the press going for like 40 years. And it's quite an amazing book, and it's all about being in the moment, you know. It's all about being in the moment. And, you know, Suzuki is talking about how we should be totally open in the moment and how we should be totally open to the moment. And, you know, he talks about sitting properly, observing your posture, watching your breath. And then he urges people not to have any expectations and any desiring any outcomes from their practice. And he talks about these very simple things in a way that is so illuminating, you know. Of course, if you read the book, you realize that the kind of practice he's doing is very, very difficult. You know, it's very, very difficult for us to completely be present with what's happening because of, it's complicated, right? It's worth asking, why is it so hard to be present? You know, why is it so difficult? And, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you try to be present, you know, you discover that you're very distracted. Last night we had some new people. We had three new people who came to sit. And one of the people was a landscape architect, and she was very interested in Asian architecture and Chinese and Japanese architecture and landscaping. And she was enthralled by the meditation practice. There was another person who actually is he's a double major, and he's a music, one of his majors is music, and he was actually a sitar player. He wasn't from India, he's an American. But he plays the sitar, and I said, oh, you know, the meditation practice will be really relevant to your sitar practice. But he had a very hard time with it, and afterward he said that was extremely difficult. You know, and you would think, what's so difficult about sitting? You know, and this might be related to the fact that I'm always astonished at how difficult it is to practice on one's own. You know, I've been doing this for 35 years, but I generally have some of my best sits when I sit with other people. And when I was younger, it used to be very difficult for me to practice on my own, you know. And I know that beginners have a very hard time. You know, people come here and I introduce the practice to them. And one of the things I always say is that if you try to do this on your own, you'll probably quit. And I wonder why it is that that's so true for so many people. You know, you would think that it would not be so difficult to set aside half an hour every day to do some meditation. But it's actually quite difficult. You know, typically what happens is people say, okay, I'm going to start meditating. Day one, they meditate. Day two, they think, I'll do it tomorrow. You know, day three, they don't do it. It's over, right? So, you know, it's very difficult for people who are beginners, who don't have a structure like this, to do meditation. But what makes it so difficult? What makes it so difficult? And I think what makes it so difficult is that meditation requires so much trust. You know, so much trust. You know, when we sit down on the cushion, generally speaking, we have expectations. We have ideas of what's going to happen. We have all kinds of things going on in our head that we brought to the cushion. Maybe we're seeking an answer to something, a resolution to something. And, you know, Suzuki's practice, it was so pure because I think Zen mind, beginner's mind, is all about sitting with pure trust, right? In pure trust. And so that means having no expectations for or against anything. You know, one way to think about what meditation practice entails is that we're making ourselves available to the universe in an unconditional way. This is the truth, you know. It's a highfalutin talk. But, you know, actually, you know, meditation isn't really about mental health. It really isn't about achieving enlightenment. It really isn't about, cultivating samadhi. It's about trust. And by the way, trust is very difficult for everybody, including me. You know, but really pure practice of the kind that Shunryu Suzuki practiced was all about just making yourself available to the universe. That's mindfulness meditation. That's shikantaza, pure presentness. Yeah, and whatever arises will be your mind. And that takes tremendous trust. Really, I think trust is what this is all about. The willingness to say, okay, whatever happens is okay. And my personal feeling is that that's how Suzuki lived his life, and that's why that terrible, terrible, nightmarish event did not ruin his life, you know, is that he had cultivated Zen as a practice of trust. He understood so well that this practice is about trust. Making yourself available to the universe moment by moment, which is very difficult for us, but quite rare. But if we can live that way, I think we're really quite a bit happier. I was reading some neuroscientists. This is the age of neuroscience. So every week there's another book of brain science. And some of these brain science books are really quite ridiculous if you think about it. You know, they're telling us that our brains are involved in the decisions we make. So, you know, Nat, you wouldn't be so surprised if when you're hungry, part of your brain lit up and showed that you were hungry, right? It's not so surprising. So some of this brain research is really, really quite silly, really. But some of it's kind of interesting. And I was listening to these two neuroscientists, and they were talking about how little, free choice does not really exist, that it's really something we manufacture. And I thought that was, I wasn't, I'm still not sure how to deal with that. But I suppose it's possible that that's true, you know. I once knew a Zen teacher who absolutely was convinced. He told me that we really don't control anything. Now I'm not ready to sign on to that, right? I'm not ready to say that's true. But this Zen teacher told me that we don't control anything at all. That's entirely an illusion. And it wasn't Webb, by the way. So, just in case you're wondering. But it's certainly the case that if we can trust, if we can let go, we feel a great sense of liberation, yeah, and this wonderful life energy. You know, if you've been doing Zen for more than a year, I'm sure you've had this experience where you come in and you sit down on the cushion and you're all tangled up. And basically, you're sitting is a big struggle. It's like your will is pulling you in one direction, and the world is pushing you in another direction. And the whole sit is like this struggle or this tension between what you want to have happen and what's happening. You know. And at some point, all of this can just vanish. This is really one of the most wonderful things about sitting, is that at some point, all of this just vanishes, and you find yourself sort of empty-headed and blank, and you're just present with the moment. And you're not trying to control events, you're not judging, you're just being present. And in this state, generally speaking, people feel great happiness. Yeah, great happiness. So I don't know if it's true or not that that we don't control anything, that control is an illusion. But it's definitely the case that if we can trust, we will be happier. We will, and there's this tremendous energy that comes from not trying to control things or not clinging to our expectations. And we waste huge amounts of energy worrying. I myself am quite a worrier, as a matter of fact. I hope that won't discourage you from Zen practice. I myself can be quite a worrier, and actually one of the reasons I do Zen is that it helps me deal with my worrier personality. That's worrier, not warrior. if I let myself, I will worry about things that are quite trivial, and I'll worry a lot about them. And I worry about almost everything that's important as well. So, you know, when I sit down on the cushion, it's really quite wonderful not to have to worry. And it's very liberating, you know. I highly recommend this as a practice because it's so intensely liberating to let go and say, you know, whatever happens is going to be okay. Now, normally, that is a terrifying proposition, right? But when you're in samadhi, when you've entered into deep samadhi, you know, there's a state in which your mind really does become blank. And it's totally stable and at rest. And it's observing in a neutral way. This happens all the time. This is a quite important aspect of Zen practice. This morning, I had some pain in my legs, and the second round of sitting was difficult for me, and I really had to concentrate. And I was sort of right on the edge of my pain, you know. And then when I got up and I went to the bathroom, I noticed my mind was so deeply in samadhi. It's just like there was no thinking, basically just 100% perception of what was happening around me, and that wonderful samadhi feeling, you know. And that's, to me, that's a very liberating condition, you know. So, especially now that I don't have my mother to perform free therapy for me. being able to get to that state is quite important, quite liberating. It's like it's terrifying to trust in ordinary consciousness, because that's the consciousness that thinks and calculates and worries. And if you do worry too much, you will be paralyzed, you know. There's a wonderful Zen story that is just a classic, and I may have told it before, but it's so perfect, right? In my home, in my house, this may say something about my wife and about me as housekeepers, but there's lots of millipedes around. I don't know if you've ever seen a millipede, but they're long insects. In fact, they may not even be insects. I'm not sure what order they belong to, but they're long creatures that have like a not really a thousand legs, but they have a lot of legs, and they move very quickly. They're very fast, and basically they're sort of a silver color, and they move right across the floor, and they have like a thousand legs. So. There are millipedes in Japan also, and there's a story, a Zen story, about a millipede is going across the floor, and it's just flowing smoothly. They just move effortlessly, right? They have 100 legs, and they just scoot right across the floor. And it's going by an ant, and the ant watches it, and it says, wow, that's amazing. You have 1,000 legs, you know. How do you do that? And the millipede stopped, started thinking about it, and then it died. Right? How do I do this? You know, how is this possible? Right? And it had lost its trust. Right? As long as it was unselfconsciously moving, everything went well. The minute it began to doubt itself, it was dead in the water. Right? So this is really a very important aspect of our practice, is having this trusting mind. You know, everything changes, and because everything changes, we can live in fear and anxiety, as we often do. But when we sit down on the cushion, it's possible to live a different kind of life. It's possible to have a different way of approaching this everything changes world. And in my opinion, the best way to greet change is with this empty mind, with this trusting mind, which is not a philosophical attitude, but an actual cognitive state. So, you know, Zen is not a philosophy. When I was young, I was very interested in Stoic philosophy, if you're into Western classics. The Stoics were these people who believed that really there was no God, and you had to be detached, and they had lots of little moral sayings that were very inspiring, you know, and so on. But you know, in some ways, it was all baloney, because basically they were all just trying to convince themselves of something. But Zen, I think Zen is really quite different from that, because in ordinary consciousness, it's almost impossible to trust. But when we enter deep samadhi, we really do enter a mind that isn't judging, and it's not self-centered, and it's deeply connected, and trust becomes really quite easy in that state. So, this koan goes, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? Now, you know, it's obvious in a certain way that winter comes and winter goes, and summer comes and summer goes, and so on. We all know, you know, when you're 17 years old, there is no such thing as death. But as you approach a certain age, you know, you suddenly realize death is inevitable. You know, death is on the way. You know, my life has a limit, you know, and I'm somewhere in the last third of my life, something like that. So we all know about that kind of transitoriness, right? That you know, our kids grow up, you know, that happens. Just to digress, I've probably told this story before. I've probably told it 100 times, but you know, a friend of mine had cancer. And this was many years ago, and she might not have made it. So I was going over to her house a couple times every week. She lives in my neighborhood, and we were doing meditation practice together. And her daughter, whose name is Hannah, used to be there sometimes, and she was the cutest little girl, and she had a book bag. And on the book bag, there were these tassels with all these little beads on them. I guess that was the hip thing, 18 years ago, was for little girls to have book bags with these tassels and these very cool beads, these ceramic beads. And I would go over and I would see her book bag, and then we'd do, she and her mother would do meditation with me. Or her mother would do meditation with me. Anyway, her mother didn't die. Her mother survived. Her mother went on to lead a very good life and is still alive. And I saw her one day and I said, "How is Hannah?" This was recently. I said, "How is Hannah? Does she still have that wonderful little book bag?" And my friend said, "Kurt, Hannah is in college now." You know? In my mind, she was still this little kid with this, and that's where I stopped having contact with her. So she's eternally a little kid with a book bag. But we know, you know, generally speaking, that kids grow up, they throw their book bags away, or we put them in the attic, and so on. That's one kind of transience, you know. And there's another kind, though, that's very important. You know, if you, if it takes a few years, but if you're sitting in deep samadhi, you're watching the moments go by, you know. So you're watching the breath, and then you notice the sound of the fan overhead. And then you hear somebody cough, you know, and you're watching your breath, and you feel pain in your leg or something. You know, especially if you have, if you're not sitting in a room like this one, but you're in a room where there's a little bit more sensory input. So a good example would be like bird, hearing the sound of a bird, a repetitive sound of a bird. You know. You know, I invite you to listen to something like that. If you're doing meditation at home and there's lots of birds, try to zero in on a sound like a bird sound singing that's repetitive, that just keeps repeating. And one of the things you'll notice is that you hear the sound and then there's this big empty space in your mind. It's like there's a sound and the sound drifts off and there's like this moment that's just like blank. And then there's a sound, and there's a moment that's blank. This is might seem a little strange, but the Zen view is, excuse me, pollen. The Zen view is that consciousness is not continuous in the way we think. If you meditate long enough, you'll notice that there are empty spaces between the things you are aware of. So that consciousness is not like a series of impressions or a series, unbroken series of moments of awareness. But basically, your moments of awareness are punctuated or interrupted by these blank spaces, which are very difficult to notice. When I was a kid, we used to have movies on the base, the military base where my dad was stationed. We would have on Saturday night, we'd have movies. And they were a quarter, so it was a good deal. You could go to the base club, and there was a movie theater in the base club, and we would all pay a quarter, and we would go in and watch these movies. And they were usually rather maybe five-year-old movies that the armed forces had the right to show on their bases. And I remember a couple times going to the movies, and you'd be watching the movie, and then the projector would begin to go out, would begin to go on the fritz. And sometimes the bulb would burn out, and then the thing would just go black. And then there'd be a pause, and basically we'd all start talking and waiting, and then the movie would come back on. But every once in a while, the timing would be off on the projector. And what would happen is, you know, instead of seeing a continuous stream of images, you would see individual flashes on the screen. This is like an old-time, you know, like home movies do this too, right? If the speed is not correct, you begin to notice you begin to notice individual frames are making up the moving images. This is really quite commonplace. The fact is that our minds take out the spaces, or the spaces are so brief we don't notice them. So the images seem continuous. It seems like a continuous stream of images, but if you slow it down a little bit, you notice that actually a movie is a series of images projected on a screen, a series of still images projected very fast on a screen. If you meditate long enough, you begin to notice that this process is happening all the time. That there are individual spaces between the moments of your awareness. And you can test this out yourself by listening to a bird, say, repetitively. It has to be a sound that's repetitive. But if you listen to it carefully and you're in samadhi, you might have quite a surprise. It's a little bit like jumping off a cliff. You know, all of a sudden these spaces open up and they're quite dramatic. They can be quite dramatic. You might just notice them a little bit. But I was studying with a different Zen master, and he told me to do this. He said, go listen to a bird. And I listened to a bird, and it was like falling off a cliff into nothingness. And I went in to see him, and I said, that's amazing, you know. And he laughed. He said, yeah, isn't it? That's really cool. You know? So please give it a try. But the lesson is not just that it's cool or that it's an interesting phenomenon, but that, you know, basically everything is arising and disappearing all the time on a scale that we don't normally notice. It's quite very much the case that impermanence is even more present than we realize. You know, that things are coming into being and going away and dropping into this blankness very, very fast all around us. And so, you know, what looks like a stable world, what looks like a stable and continuous reality is really like a highly unstable change, symphony of change, you could say. You know, as I say, you have to be in very deep concentration to notice this, probably. This could be a terrifying insight, you know, that everything is changing, that the people we love are going to disappear, that our life circumstances constantly change our situations, that the tree in the backyard that we love to get struck by lightning, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Those empty spaces in your meditation practice, those moments where you encounter this blankness are really quite consequential. Because when you go to that place, you find that it's tremendously purifying. You know, when you go to that blankness, when you're able to reach that blankness, and when you can spend a little time there, It's tremendously liberating, tremendously consoling and purifying, and also energizing. There's this tremendous energy. In the West, we have a long history of thinking about nothingness as a terrible, terrible thing. You know, the Greeks actually had a word for nothingness. It was chaos, believe it or not. That chaos didn't mean craziness, it meant emptiness. But the Greeks didn't like chaos. Some of their early philosophers said, pay attention to chaos. Pay attention to nothingness. It's very important. But on the whole, the Greeks thought, no way. You know, they were like a bon vivants. You know, they like wine and music and so on. And they just didn't get into emptiness. You know. And later, the idea that emptiness is important was not a big part of Christianity either. Something is always better than nothing. That's a teaching of a great Christian theologian. So we have a prejudice. Nothingness sounds terrible. It sounds awful, you know. But Asian people long ago discovered that nothingness is this incredibly energizing, liberating state, and very productive. That every something comes out of some nothing. You know, every something originates in nothing. You know, I was listening again to a cosmologist. They're like brain scientists. They're on the radio all the time. And this guy has just written this new book called something like How Everything Came Out of Nothing. And he said, you know, actually, the universe is, basically pulsing between something and nothing all the time. And he said, universes come out of emptiness. You know, it's just like straight Buddhism. And he said, you know, basically nothingness is not what we think. He said, there is nothing in the universe, and then there's something. And he says the something comes out of the quantum instability in the nothingness, which I thought was wonderful. So I didn't study quantum instability in physics. I studied waves and sound and electricity. That was as far as I got. So I don't really understand quantum instability. But I do know this, that emptiness is really quite wonderful, and that it's not at all this negative condition. It's deeply enlivening and purifying. The Asian people in India discovered this. The Buddha's word for emptiness was shunyata, zeroness. And indeed, people in India discovered zero and passed it on to the Arabic world, and then it came to the West very late because of our prejudice against nothingness. But zeroness was what the Buddha used to describe this state of emptiness from which everything arises very dynamically. And in Chinese culture as well, this was very important. You know, if you look at carpets in the Middle Ages in Europe, you'll see that every square inch of the carpet is covered with something. You know, you've got to put something somewhere. And indeed, if you look at Persian carpets, it's pretty much the same. Every square inch is covered. But if you look at Chinese carpets, you know, it's curious, especially the older ones. They crank them out now by the millions in mainland China, and they sometimes are beautiful and sometimes not so beautiful. But the old ones are really quite beautiful. And they were quite interesting because they have a lot of empty space. So there's something, and then there's this emptiness. There's this alternation of something and nothing in the Chinese carpet. And this is also true in Japanese gardens. So if you go to Ryoanji, for example, and you see the raked gravel, you know, you basically have gravel, and between the gravel you have these lines, you know, these dark lines. This is something, nothing, something. This is the oscillation of something and nothing. So it's a little Zen lesson for you. In the Diamond Sutra, which we recite at Zashin, and we recite it today, we recite it in Japanese phonetic pronunciation of Chinese, which was a phonetic pronunciation of Sanskrit. So Chinese monks reciting this know that it doesn't mean anything. It's a phonetic version of a Sanskrit sutra. And the Japanese took the Chinese and made their own Japanese phonetic version. But if you read the translation, what you'll discover is that it says basically there is no suffering, there is no obstacle that cannot be liberated, from which you cannot be liberated by encountering emptiness. That emptiness cuts through all suffering and all illusion. The sutra is a dialogue between Avalokiteshvara Guanyin, and another bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva says, you know, tell me about emptiness. And it says the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara was in deep samadhi, and in deep samadhi of emptiness, and says, you know, the truth is that everything arises out of emptiness. Form is empty, and empty is emptiness is form. And then he says, everything you, all your suffering, whatever your suffering, whatever your problem, if you go into deep mushin, if you go into emptiness, and you stay there long enough, you're going to experience this tremendous liberation and energy. And he says, that's the truth. He actually says, that is the truth, not a lie, which I think is wonderful. So anyway, you know, we live in a world that seems to be transient, you know, impermanent. That seems obvious enough. But it's actually more impermanent than we thought. And this could be a terrible thing, but actually, when you begin to do Zen practice and you encounter the dynamic character of change, it's hard not to be a little excited and happy about being alive. And in fact, you know, one of the implications of all this is that it's hard for anything not to be alive. That basically existence, in a certain sense, is really indestructible. I mean, if you destroy the whole universe, you're just going to get another universe. You know, that's very fancy talk, but it's kind of interesting, don't you think? That, you know, the worst thing we can imagine is that everything would be destroyed. But actually, if that happens, everything is going to come back. So in a certain way, you know, people think of Buddhism as being very pessimistic. You know, this is very pessimistic. I never have understood that, you know. Because whenever I do meditation, I feel so good. You know, I feel very optimistic. But, you know, the basic lesson of all this is that life is indestructible.